that takes them into account so that they're no longer refugees. These Palestine refugees are not citizens of a country, and therefore UNRWA runs services that are like public services, schools and health centers, until there's a political solution, and hopefully they no longer have that status in limbo of a refugee.
How do you respond to Senate Republicans who introduced a bill to block funds for UNRWA, accusing it of teaching anti-Semitic school curricula and harboring terrorists in its facilities, Tamara?
I respond by reminding of the extremely thorough reviews we do of all our teaching material. Page by page is reviewed to ensure that nothing we teach in our school, over 700 schools, runs against the UN values and principles. But I also respond that if UNRWA ceased to exist tomorrow, then there is a huge layer of stabilizing and stability that UNRWA usually offers in a very, very, very volatile area that also collapses. It is in everyone's interest that the UNRWA schools, the health centers, the food assistance, and the protection continues, because besides its humanitarian and human rights value, it has a stabilizing impact on the region.
And what do you say to the Israeli military that says they won't allow in fuel because Hamas will take it?
I will say that our trucks take the fuel from the borders into our depots, into our warehouses, and that we use it directly, or we deliver it directly to the bakeries and the hospitals. So there's no intermediary between the fuel and the beneficiaries. We are the only entity responsible for using that fuel.
Finally, Tamara, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has repeatedly called for a ceasefire. That has not been accomplished at this point. There have been protests around the world demanding a ceasefire. The first Jewish American Congress member, Becca Ballant of Vermont, has joined scores of other Congress members in calling for a ceasefire. But especially around the UN, at this point, what can it do?
It can continue calling for a ceasefire. I want to notice that several countries have called for a ceasefire, including France, and that without a ceasefire, it's going to be very difficult to come back from the brink or to de-escalate. So the UN, on the political side, different UN member states must continue to push for a ceasefire. And on the humanitarian side, we must continue to advocate for more funding and for more access to different parts of the Gaza Strip. Because right now, the access of aid agencies is almost entirely restricted to the south. The north is completely sealed, but we have to be able to reach people where they are. And for that, we need a ceasefire.
We thank you so much for being with us. Tamara Arifai, spokesperson for UNRWA, the United Nations Agency for Palestine Refugees. We're going to break now. When we come back, we'll talk more about what's happening in Gaza. Stay with us. Thank you. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. To talk more about the dire situation in Gaza, we're joined by Mohammed Shahada, a writer and analyst from Gaza, chief communications at Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor, and a columnist at the Forward newspaper, a Jewish weekly. In New York. He's joining us from Copenhagen, where there have been a number of protests. In fact, Mohammed, can you start with those protests? We are covering the protests here in the country and around the world. What's happening in Copenhagen?
That was actually pretty remarkable. I've never seen a protest of that size in Denmark for at least the last 2 years. There was the climate march last year in November around the elections time. So every political party was very keen to show up there, including the prime minister. But the demonstration yesterday for Gaza was almost twice the size of Denmark's climate march. And the climate is a very huge topic here. And it's been a tremendous ongoing daily movement where people move with demonstrations every night to different locations of Denmark's capital to make a statement about the necessity of a ceasefire and to stop the bloodshed in Gaza. So it's been extraordinary.
And do people there face the same issue that they face in the United States, being accused by some that if they criticize Israel, they're automatically anti-Semitic?
Yeah, absolutely. There's plenty of that. Even the Danish prime minister, she laid a wreath of flowers at the Israeli embassy, and then she was asked, would you do the same to Palestinian victims? And she said, there is no comparison whatsoever. Israel is defending itself. Hamas is a terrorist organization. So that was basically the sentiment. It's the same in Danish media. So, for instance, the question of do you condemn Hamas is, again, the same question asked to any person of color whenever they want to talk about what Israel has done to them and their own families in Gaza. And the media bias is very visible as well.
In the last few days, the Israeli military completely controls the media of international journalists in Gaza. It does not let them in unless they are embedded with the Israeli military and they review their video, unless they're, you know, journalists, Gazan journalists, Palestinian journalists inside Gaza, of course, are there operating. So many of them, more than 30 of them have been killed. But in the last few days, the Israeli military has brought in journalists from BBC, from CNN, and they show them a hole at Al-Shifa Hospital, where they say this goes directly down right near Al-Shifa, into the ground and then underneath Al-Shifa. Can you talk about what we understand at this point?
Yeah, absolutely. As you said, Amy, it's very horrendous to see journalists agreeing to these humiliating conditions that basically mean anything they convey is literal propaganda, because there's three conditions. You're not allowed to speak to any Palestinian or Gazan to challenge what the IDF is spoon-feeding you. You're not allowed to go beyond the tour that the IDF has staged, so you stick to what the IDF wants to show you and where they take you. And you have to review the material with them before you publish. So the result of that is not journalism, it's propaganda. But with Al-Shifa Hospital, what we've seen is basically for Gaza's main medical complex of giant symbolic value and of important a crucial necessity to the lives of thousands. There were about 50,000 people sheltering there. For Israel to say that it has lost its protected status, it has a huge burden of proof to show that the hospital was used to direct or engage in hostilities against it. But up until now, what we have, the facts that we know, is that not a single bullet was fired against the IDF from the hospital over the last week, where they have operated in the hospital completely. Not a single bullet, not a single footage of a Hamas rocket being fired from the hospital, and not a single evidence of the sprawling, alleged sprawling command and control centers that Israel has published a CGI animated footage of and claimed that they knew the precise entrance to. They have not shown any of that. And they have not shown or captured any Hamas militants in the hospital or Hamas members. So basically, there is no satisfying proof for the hospital to lose its protected status. And for what Israel has inflicted on the hospital for the last week, they starved, literally starved everyone inside. About 8 babies were suffocated to death. 22 people in the ICU units were killed, and 6 dialysis patients were killed. The overall totality of how many people killed were there were 53 in total. So that is very atrocious. And as you said, the only evidence that Israel had to show for it was a hole in the ground. And I consulted with experts in Gaza, experienced engineers who are familiar with sort of different structures that were observed, for instance, Hamas tunnels, and they said that does not look like a Hamas tunnel whatsoever, because you have 2 very giant, very solid concrete columns on both sides of the entrance, the shaft's entrance. And these can only be built by pouring cement down in a mold and vibrating every time you pour a little bit and vibrate it with a concrete vibrator and wait for it to dry. And that takes days, and it makes a huge noise in a hospital in full view of thousands of people going in and out on a daily basis. That's not how you build a secret tunnel. And the IDF has not allowed anyone to go inside the alleged tunnel to see what's in it. But even if you presume that it is a tunnel, the IDF would still have a burden of proof to show that Hamas was actually using it at the time of the IDF raid to essentially legitimize that raid, or using it at all during that war. They have not shown any evidence of that.
I saw one Israeli military spokesperson showing a CNN reporter and saying, we believe that at the bottom there where you see a metal door, they haven't opened it because they say they're afraid there are explosives that are attached to it. It would make some kind of sharp turn, and that would then go under the hospital. So they haven't shown that the thing, that the tunnel itself is under the hospital. They say what's behind it, what they can't see, they think makes a turn.
Yeah, but even with that door, I know that Hamas and other militant groups were abiding by a very strict decision since 2014, at least, to not have any military activities in or around hospitals, because that was previously Israel's pretext for bombing medical facilities and schools and homes. So they say they had a strict decision not to use it. You don't need to believe Hamas, but you take a statement that Gaza's Ministry of Health and Hamas as well have made. They said that we would allow any international expedition, a group of experts, to come into Gaza and vet and scrutinize every little aspect of the hospital without any of the patients dying. And Israel's answer to that has been a resounding refusal. So if Israel had more than a week, they had 8 days inside the hospital, daily operations, uninterrupted, unattacked, unimpeded, going through every single room, every single detail, and still unable to show any traces of Hamas using the hospital for military activities, the IDF propaganda becomes more or less a laughingstock than actual sort of evidence or communication, especially when last week they went to a children's hospital, the Rantisi Hospital, after doing the same, surrounding it, besieging it, starving people inside, forcing them out at gunpoint. And then once they went inside, the spokesperson of the IDF, he went to the basement and he showed a piece of paper on the wall and he said, this shows the names of Hamas terrorists that were guarding hostages here. And he showed a baby nappy and a bottle of milk. And he said, that's proof. A bottle of milk in a children's hospital where thousands of people were taking refuge. But even with the list that he showed on the wall, it was basically a calendar with the name Saturday, Sunday, Monday. So if you believe Monday is a terrorist, a legitimate target, go ahead and kill Monday. You would have my utmost sympathy.
Do you have any information on the latest negotiations? Deal where dozens of hostages would be released by Hamas, particularly women and children. Prisoners would be released by Israel. There are thousands of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. And there would be some kind of ceasefire.
There's plenty of proposals that have been put on the table, and I've been following them up very meticulously. So the priority right now is to get Israeli children, women and elderly, and civilian hostages altogether, especially foreigners, released and returned to Israel. And Hamas alleges that some of them were kidnapped by other groups once the fence collapsed, and that they still need to audit and collect these hostages and release them, which is why they've been asking for a temporary ceasefire for 5 days to allow them to go and find the hostages held by more minor and less known groups, Alawite Nasser Salah al-Din, Sara al-Quds, Kitab Mujahideen, etc. So basically, that's one of the reasons. The other is the negotiations where it stopped is Hamas promised to release about 50 to 70 civilian hostages on stages during a 5 day ceasefire in return, mainly for Israel to allow food and humanitarian aid and fuel to go to all of Gaza, especially the north, because now the northern half, Israel has not been allowing any food, water, electricity, or fuel to go inside the north for the last 44 days. It has become a death zone to force people out and to defeat Hamas militarily by besieging and starving everyone and randomly even killing everyone inside. So basically, Hamas's condition was that Israel allows aid to go to the north for people that are still there, tens of thousands, if not over 100,000 people, and to allow fuel to go to, through the United Nations to run, for instance, the Gaza's sole power plant, to power water distillation facilities and water sewage treatment facilities, etc., to prevent diseases and a humanitarian catastrophe. So that has been the demand. There are two logistical stumbling blocks that are obstructing the talks. They say the two sides are almost in agreement, but the two major blocks is basically Hamas asking that people who fled to the south be allowed during these 5 days of ceasefire. They should be allowed to go back if they wanted to, or people in the north to go south. And Israel is objecting to that. And Hamas is asking the Israeli military tanks and vehicles on the ground to pull back a little bit to allow for the hostages to be taken out and to be moved to Rafah, where they would be released, and also in the south as well. And they're asking the Israelis to suspend their drone surveillance on top of Gaza, because they are afraid that Israel would use that moment of the hostage release to find out the hideouts of Hamas and their military infrastructure. So it's more of a logistical militant demand than sort of a substantial block. But Israel is still refusing, as I said, the entry of humanitarian aid and fuel to the northern half, and they are refusing the return of people that were displaced south, their return back to the north.
Mohammed Sirhad, I want to thank you for being with us, writer and analyst from Gaza, chief of communications at Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor, columnist with the Forward newspaper, a Jewish weekly here in New York, joining us from Copenhagen. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show remembering the 74-year-old Canadian-Israeli peace activist Vivian Silver. She was killed October 7th during the Hamas attack on Kibbutz Be'eri, where she lived. She was declared dead only last week after Israeli authorities identified her remains. Up until last week, her family thought she may have been taken hostage. Vivian Silver had co-founded the Arab-Jewish Center for Equality, Empowerment, and Cooperation and was a member of Women Wage Peace. In 2017, she joined a march of Israeli and Palestinian women to the shores of the Jordan River to call for an end to Israel's occupation.
Are organizing women from all over the country, from every side of the political spectrum, who are saying, enough. Must speak in Arabic, it's makafi. Enough. We're no longer willing to do this. We must reach a political agreement. We must change the paradigm that we have been taught for 7 decades now, where we've been told that only war will bring peace. We don't believe that anymore. It's been proven that it's not true.
Those were the words of Vivian Silver in 2017. On Thursday, friends and family and relatives of Vivian Silver gathered for her memorial service. During a recent BBC interview, her son, Yonatan Zeigen, was asked what his mother would say about what's happening in Israel and Gaza now.
That this is the outcome. This is the outcome of war, of not striving for peace. We've been, you know, Israelis have that saying, living on our sword. And this is what happens. It's, you know, it's very overwhelming, but it's not completely surprising. We couldn't, it's not sustainable to live in a state of war for so long. And now it bursts. It burst.
We're joined now by Sama Salaimi. She is a writer at 972 Magazine, a Palestinian feminist activist. Her most recent piece, A Tribute to Vivian, which went viral. In the piece, Samah writes, quote, "Nothing prepared me for yesterday's bitter news of Vivian's tragic end. I felt deep despair, like a bottomless sinkhole had opened under the foundations of humanity, where thousands are already buried, men, women, children, innocent Palestinians and Israelis, people who'd wish for peace and did not live to see that wish fulfilled," Sama Salaimi wrote. Sama, welcome to Democracy Now! Under horrific circumstances. Can you tell us more about Vivian and your response last week that you, when you learned, no, she wasn't a hostage as you all and her family had hoped, but she had died at the kibbutz she lived on for decades, Be'eri?
Yeah. So thank you for the invitation, and I will use the few minutes that you give me to introduce Vivian Silver to your audience. Vivian was a feminist, very optimistic woman, and she believed in people, she believed in humanity, and she make a difference in every room that she joined, every group or initiative or any peace process that she wished to be part of. Vivian, for 5 decades, dedicated her life to make shared life possible in Israel. She truly believe of partnership between Palestinian and Israelis to end this fascist, ugly conflict that we all live in. Vivian passed away. She was killed, and we didn't know. We all believe, all her friends, we believe that she's became a hostage, like 240 hostages, because the army told her family that there is no any evidence that something bad happened to her, and they believe it. And circumstance, we all the friends, all the feminists and peace activists prayed for her safety, and we truly believe that she will know how to communicate with people in Gaza. She was in Gaza, so she visited Gaza many times, and when after the siege started, she insisted to take Palestinian kids from the checkpoint, from the border to the hospitals inside Israel, and she combined them. We have a dream that one of these kids that she helped will find her and will communicate with her in Gaza. These images were wishful thinking for anyone, for everyone, and we had to deal with the devastating, sad news that she's gone. And the painful thing in Israel that there are some people who used her memory to justify the war in Gaza, something that she really didn't believe in, force and militarism and bombs. And she really wanted and fighted for peaceful process and peaceful ending for this conflict. And for example, one of the Israeli activists put her name on a rocket that was supposed to bomb Gaza for her memory. And this is quite the opposite thing that Vivian teach us. The Minister of Security and Internal Security in Israel, Ben-Gvir, is this extremist fascist minister in Netanyahu's government. Also posted in his Twitter account saying that this this is what the Palestinians do with people who believe in peace, and she paid the price. And this kind of ugliness and harassment and incitement against peace activists, this is the atmosphere here. We were not allowed to demonstrate, and still against the war, we cannot shout as Palestinian activists inside Israel that we need and we want ceasefire. Any gathering between Arab and Jewish is now forbidden in Israel. But what the death of the murder of Vivian succeed to do is to gather hundreds of people in her memorial, Arab and Jewish people, Palestinian and Israelis, men and women, religious and secular, from all the aspect, all the region, came to say goodbye to this wonderful, amazing, prominent woman.
We had hoped to have her son Yonatan on as well, but he is still sitting shiva right now since the funeral, still mourning his mother's death. Is it true that someone wrote Vivian's name on a rocket that would be used in Gaza?
This is one of the photos that one of the activists showed me during the memorial, and I was shocked by this this photo. Someone posted that on the social media for her memorial, which is, it's like putting a salt in our open wound, and it's we both cried to see this, because this is not the memorial thing. That is something that Vivian Silver will do or wish or want her name on any military action or violent tool. She used to say that if your only tool is a hammer, everything, every problem around you will look like a nail that you have to hit it. And the Palestinian-Israeli conflict have to be dealt with different tool, and you have to be creative, and we have to be optimistic. We have to speak and to keep the dialogue going on, and to compromise to find the solution, and not to keep this circle of blood going every 2 years. And this was her legacy, and this is what we have to march for and fight for after her death.
We just have a minute to go, but Sama, what do you want to see happen now, and what do you think Vivian would be saying right now?
I think Vivian, as we know her, with her sarcasm and great sense of humor, she will gather us as a group of women. She will speak, and she will break the law by organizing demonstrations against the war. And she will call for ceasefire now. She will have the courage to share photos and images from Gaza, and usually always have this unique courage voice that nobody have around her. And she will be the voice of Palestinian families, Palestinian colleagues, and Palestinian innocent people that send us all the time messages that they are very sad for her loss, and they are missing her, and they could not be at the memorial because of the war. Vivian will march around and will break the siege. She will do everything, you know, against this war. And she usually have this, I don't know where she bring this power from, to recruit people, and what people will follow. And this is her energy, and we...
Well,
certainly, the peace movement in Israel-Palestine.
Sama Salami, I want to thank you so much for being with us. We'll link to your piece in 972 Magazine. I'm Amy Goodman.
Hi, this is Jesse Brown, the host of Canada Land, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week, I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.
We appreciate your generosity. Each year for a week, we host Fundrive, our annual fundraising campaign that boosts our budget and supports our operations. Thank you for your support.
The screen.